This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is December 3rd, 2020, and this is episode 218.
I'm Scott Delinnebohm.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, Daryl Plekis. Remember him? He's back. He's got one last, a pair of reports for the legislature after he's no longer an MLA. And Trudeau has finally given us a fiscal update and is clearly warming up the money printer once more. First, thanks to the 99 people who contribute every month. Thanks to Jack for upping their pledge. It helps make up for the few people we lost last month. It sounds like largely due to financial difficulties. We do know times are still tough. We appreciate every dollar you can spare to help make these shows possible. And you can support us at patreon.com/politicoast. Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to politicstoday.news/free-trial. Let's kick it off with some 2020 legislative vision. Let's look ahead at what's likely to be the shortest, almost possible legislative session. On Monday, the legislature resumes with the new Horgan majority government for what will probably be at most a two-week session. And the other half of it is there's a big new report from the Speaker's Forum. It's actually not that long, but Plekis is in the news again, so we'll have to talk about him. But let's look at the session to come. Throne speech Monday. Anything you expect in it besides, I guess, just what the NDP campaigned on?
Oh, that's exactly what I expect. It is. Their campaign was basically a stay the course is everything we've done. We want to, you know, more or less do the same thing, just take the next step on all of it. The post-election press conferences that Horgan gave are all kind of in that same vein. Same thing with the mandate letters we talked about last week. I see absolutely no reason why that trend would be bucked with the throne speech.
It seems like the only reason we're really having a super short session is to get this $1,000 rebate Horgan buck check that he promised every household. They haven't talked about any other bills or legislation that needs to be passed this urgently, nothing that can wait till January or February. And I think there was even some hints to the media that was being criticized by the Liberals of pushing the budget back to March because of the difficulty it would take to get a full budget in place earlier because of a snap election, which is funny.
They should still more or less be able to do it. That's a fairly long gap between when the election was and when a budget's going to be rolling out. And the process would have already gotten started back in the summer, the various committees starting their work on that. Yeah, snap election made things a little harder, but it's not out of the question, especially because no government has changed at all. All the priorities were the same now as they were before. You had a Carol James wasn't out campaigning. She was in the caretaker government. It's like finance wasn't exactly just left twiddling their thumbs. I don't see a reason you can't get it out at the normal time.
You don't have to negotiate with the Greens anymore. You can just put what you want in it. I think what might slow it down a little is whether there's any retooling. Like you said, the committee consultations on the budget started, I think, in June this year, and they were online. But there's a chance now with the majority government, the NDP could go bolder or bigger or switch directions on a couple of things, prioritize some things, deprioritize other things that would otherwise have maintained the status quo. But I guess we'll have to see in the spring when the budget does come versus what supply bill we get next week. The other big thing the return of the legislature can do, hopefully, is reform the major committees and the big studies that were being planned, most notably of which was the Police Act committee to look at that entire mess back in the early summer. The Black Lives Matter protests were in full force, and Mike Farnworth committed to reform and update the Police Act, which is badly needed. And they'd formed an all-party committee, and they'd started planning to discuss it. And then the election happened. So now the question will be, do they form that committee in the exact same way, where it's a three-party equal voice committee? Or does the NDP do what most majority governments do and just take control of the committee and do what they want with it?
I would guess it would be the latter.
Hopeful it would be the latter on this one. There's some issues where I think there's more value to the additional voices, but I want to see some big changes to the Police Act soon. And I don't know, just watching the debates around the Vancouver police budget where they're like, actually, we need more money. And it's this whole system is broken. They're not really transparent, accountable. We've talked numerous times about reports about challenges facing policing in this country. I want to see some big changes.
On the other hand, like, policing is still a fairly large part of our society. It's a significant line item in any government's budget. The general enforcement of laws is something that needs to be done and needs to be done well. And maybe it's one of those things that is in fact big enough that the usual strong arming that goes on when you have a majority government, maybe if you already have something in place, you just keep it and don't switch to that.
I think there's some good opportunities in this committee too as well, and a number of good MLAs that can hopefully get appointed to it. We talked last week about everyone who's in cabinet and many of the parliamentary secretaries. Rashna Singh, I mentioned, was the new parliamentary secretary for anti-racism, and I think she'd be a fantastic voice on there. Someone like Aman Gill or another one of the lawyers that they have, whether Murray Rankin or David Eby, would be good voices. Like, there are some people who would have interesting perspectives to bring there as well. And I hope they get to the hearings soon, because I think there's a lot of groups out there that have a lot of good ideas. I don't think anyone's under the illusion that the BC NDP is going to be the party that abolishes the police. That's not going to happen. We're going to see incrementalist reforms, as we always do.
Yeah, this version of the NDP is too sensible to take that on.
For all their faults. The other big thing that I guess won't be that controversial on Monday is the appointment of the new speaker. And in the last legislature, this was the hottest gossip of an entire summer. And this year, it's pretty much guaranteed to be the guy who was deputy Raj Chauhan and Spencer Chandra Herbert. And it sounds like the Liberals will put forward Norm Letnick. And because they all want the job, they'll run unopposed, and they will be the speaker and deputy, respectively, which seems reasonable. I think they're all well-liked. I miss the drama.
Yeah, there is likely to be very little drama over this. No one's going to lose their party membership over this one.
But speaking of people who lost their party memberships, the gift that was placed on our content door this morning was a new Daryl Plekis report.
Our probably last one ever.
Sadly, we've had so much fun over the years with him, from the sleuthing.
Insane road trips that they are scooping out where various wood chippers ended up, driving around the suburbs of Victoria.
And finding some clearly obvious issues in the legislature, but doing it in the most bizarre ways. It was almost the kind of situation where you had to be complicit to not expose everything. And so Plekis has just ended up being the guy who was there who went, wait, this is not all okay. I'm not the, one who's out of touch. And he just kind of said it publicly, and they went, and everyone went, yeah, no, that makes no sense. They should not be buying wood chippers for their personal, quote unquote, personal use.
Or loading up literal truckloads of alcohol.
Mm-hmm. So one of the less controversial things he did was launch what was called the Speaker's Forum on the Role for Members. And we mentioned this, I think, a couple of years ago when it was being launched, or when one of the first reports had come out. And it was Daryl Plekis's attempt as an independent speaker to really reach out to the public and try to start a dialogue on the state of our democracy in BC. And actually quite, in my view, noble and good thing. It wasn't intended to be like criticizing any individual MLA or party. It was more about how do we make this better for everyone involved. And so they did a year of roundtables and forums where they heard from all different segments of society, individuals, youths, academics, members of the media, past MLAs, so on and so forth. They started finding, in the first year, I think they found a lot of the specific problems people had with the legislature. In the second year, they started generating ideas from participants. And in the third year, they developed specific recommendations with the clerk on how the BC legislature can be improved. Most of the media I saw tweeting about this morning, I think, skimmed through the second report and saw people have a lot of zany ideas about how the legislature could be improved.
Yeah, it turns out when you put out like broad calls for ideas from the public, you get a lot of things that range from wacky to poorly thought out to actually pretty smart. But it really runs the gamut. And I think a few people in the media had fun with the wackier end of things on that.
What was your favorite? I liked Twitter. The legislative fact checker for the media, which is totally Orwellian and would never work.
Yeah, that was quite something. There was one which I sure must have been submitted by an architect, just on this one of like physically rearranging the chairs to make a less adversarial legislature, which I don't know, maybe it works on the margins, but it was very clearly someone had an over enthusiastic view of what merely changing the seating arrangement can do to our politics.
Yeah, we debated this one a little bit before the show. Not that I think it's the most important thing to do, but I did find someone had done a study at one point looking at parliaments around the world and finding that each arrangement, because the Westminster system, BC legislature, House of Commons, UK House of Commons, etc., all have this opposition government on opposite sides of the house, and they're supposed to yell at each other. And a lot of others are semicircles or classroom style even. And you get different dynamics to some extent in each of those orientations. Now, I think we both agree there are bigger changes like proportional representation and the increasing multi-party approach that can do a lot more than just rearranging the seats. But it was interesting, I think, to see the breadth of ideas people had. Many of them did have nothing to do with the authority of the speaker or the legislature to fix our society. So I did take a little bit of like frustration with some of the people tweeting out criticism of that and mocking of it, especially the like senior journalists in the legislative press gallery, who it just, I don't know, it felt a little petty, like they don't like Plekis to some extent. And so they see a report come out of from him and just want to mock it, when the year three report that has his official recommendations with the clerk is actually a much more tempered document. And the year two one with all these like individual ideas is just, here's the things we heard because of COVID and the snap election, everything got rushed. So we just threw it all together quickly for you. Do with it what you will. And like both of these reports are like 15, 20 pages, so they're pretty readable. But do we want to go through some of the ideas Plekis does have for fixing the legislature?
Sure. So yeah, overall, the report's kind of broken into three main segments. Improve program and support orientation, training, and development opportunities for members. It's the first batch of recommendations. Next up is strengthening the ability of members to fill their representative roles and accountability of the executive to parliament through changes to the parliamentary process. And finally, the other big category is increase public accessibility, awareness, and understanding of the institutions. And the 20 recommendations are split up between those three.
Yeah, the first section on helping orient, train, and develop MLAs is what you would expect. More surveys and check-ins with MLAs. Every MLA, when they're elected in BC, does get training from the Legislative Assembly staff, just basic stuff like how does it work, where do you need to go, where are the bathrooms, how votes work, etc. They want to increase that as well, trying to include some equity considerations, things about respectful workplace. It mentions the gendered consequence of heckling specifically, as well as also an ongoing effort to increase training for all MLAs, including Indigenous history, anti-racism, something like media relations.
Yeah, there's a general runabout to put in a professional development program for MLAs that captures a bunch of those, which, yeah, seems like a smart idea.
They mention a code of conduct that some other legislatures and jurisdictions have for their MLAs that BC could adopt. Right now, we have the conflict of interest rules, but there's nothing that says, here's the like basic level of decorum that MLAs expect of each other. No one else can impose a code of conduct. MLAs can, of course, be as... In the legislature, you have parliamentary privilege. You can say whatever you want and not get sued for libel, but that doesn't mean other MLAs think you should be. And so a code of conduct could be a way to...
And the House... Yeah, the House has the ability to enforce rules such as that and set requirements for its members. So even if they can't be sued for stuff they say there, the ledge could have a way to sanction them for that.
I think the second section on strengthening MLA's roles and their ability to hold the executive to account is the most interesting one. It's the one that talks a lot about the need for more private members' time, strengthening committees, actually having opposition days on the legislative calendar. The report notes that BC is one of the few Westminster jurisdictions that doesn't afford the opposition any formal days to do anything. It's just up to the government. And we've seen that for many years as governments just go, oh, it's really nice to not have to let them talk.
Yeah, that was something that I was surprised to learn when I first started really following BC politics, is just how all-powerful the government is when it comes to setting the agenda for what the legislature actually does on a day-to-day basis compared to, you know, the federal parliament, for example. So yeah, moving in that general direction of formalizing on the legislative calendar time for opposition members to do their thing, it seems like,
given the NDP now has a majority, it's not even really a risk for them. When we were in this minority situation,
I was thinking the opposite. This is less likely to, I think, go ahead now because now they have a majority. Why would they even want to give them any power at all in terms of setting this, when before they at least had to deal with the Greens and the Liberals, who could in theory cause trouble for them if they felt the overall system wasn't benefiting them?
I guess the motivation now would be there's no cost to it other than a half a day or whatever of the legislative calendar each week, and the opportunity, should the NDP ever not be in government, to hold on to that opposition day motion, because it's one of those things that I like to hope is sticky, that it's hard to get rid of once it's in there and once it's established. Versus if they tried to bring it in under the minority parliament. Like we mentioned a few times how the opposition didn't really have a way to bring down the government other than the one or two confidence votes that were held per year, mostly in the spring. Why would the NDP have made it more risky for themselves? So I can see the argument for why they could do it now just as a way to throw a bone to the opposition. Of course, that's not the nature of BC politics, but I think what these reports are trying to get to is that's the problem. We need parliamentarians to rise above their bitterly partisan nature once in a while to hopefully make the institution better. Which I think brings us to the Standing Committee on Parliamentary Reform and a dozen other things in its name that the report singles out as needing to be given more to do. They want this committee to look at decorum in the House. They want it to look at the rules around question period. And so in here, Plekis and the clerk suggests, here's where you could ban heckling, clapping, and other interruptions during question period. But on the other side, also require the government to actually give a response instead of the pro forma bullshit we've been getting used to.
So they don't. So the report doesn't actually call for the government to be forced to answer the question in question period. And I think the question period part of this was where I had the biggest issue with it, because the underlying assumption in all the recommendations, or the theme that ties them together, is, or at least the way I read it, is that the opposition needs to be better behaved and handle and do question period better. Where, if anything, I think the opposite is the case. You've said it many times, practically a truism that's called question period, not answer period. Governments are famous for ducking and dodging around the questions. And you know, question period is one of the few opportunities the opposition actually has to try and hold the government to account. It's tough as the opposition party to get any media attention. It's hard to get your points across. A good day in question period can actually be pretty impactful. And because of that, in order to foster more accountability and hold the executive to account, which is one of the, you know, things in the title of this section of the report, really, it seems to me the focus should be not on the opposition, but on the government's responsibilities in question period, which this doesn't really address.
This does ask government to be a bit more responsive to a number of other approaches, independent powers of inquiry to the legislature, requiring the government to respond to committees, as you corrected me on, and also adopting an online petition system that the government would have to respond to at a certain point. This is something the UK brought in a number of years ago. It's something Kennedy Stewart, interestingly, was actually responsible for championing at the federal level. It's not the strongest tool, but I do see a value to these.
Maybe not so rosy on that one, because sure, the government technically under the rules has to respond, but they usually give a pretty bland pro forma answer on these petitions that doesn't really substantively move anything, can barely call attention to an issue. You know, how many Canadians can actually name a single one of the petitions that has gone to the federal parliament in the last 4 years?
A couple that I've signed. One that sticks out in my mind, though, is like a petition we got a few thousand people to sign calling for a repeal of the blasphemy law. And following that, the government, as part of its broader reforms on cleaning up zombie laws in the criminal code, did include the blasphemy law in there. And so we were able to at least claim partial credit for that. Now, was it underway already? Maybe, but at least we reminded the government there's a segment of the population who cared about that. And I think...
Yeah, but like at the same time, it was a couple thousand people. And the fact that you're here on a Thursday night recording a politics podcast almost definitionally makes you atypical in how much you've paid attention to it. And like I think the... It's just not really clear that there's much in the way of actual feedback and effectiveness in terms of getting this to happen. And then you have various MPs who sponsor some pretty nuts petitions, whether it's Elizabeth May sponsoring, what is it, like 9/11?
See, those ones are fun. It's nice to know when your representatives are willing to back something that is embarrassing, at least.
I personally would have rather that the Parliament not even bother wasting its time on this rather than having to hear it because it got so many signatures and wasting valuable time in the parliament for that. But
so
if it was the case that like online these petitions were generated more effects federally, I might be more warm to this idea, but it really seems like something that's going to be more useful for organizations to try and list build off of getting people to sign than actually a way to enhance the responsiveness of the legislature to the citizens of British Columbia.
You can't list build off the federal petitions because the government holds the emails and doesn't give them out to the sponsors. The UK petition system is a little bit more interesting than Canada's. Canada's just basically has a threshold. If you get X number of petitions, the government has to give a response. In the UK, if a petition gets 10,000 signatures, the government has to issue a response to the writers. If you get 100,000 petitions, it has to be debated in Parliament. And there's been a couple times when that's happened. That's actually quite interesting. I think Brexit got debated a couple extra times. Brexit was going to be debated anyway, but there are a number of places where issues don't get debated in our parliaments because of them being viewed as third rails, like medical assistance in dying wasn't going to be debated by MPs until the courts forced it. But this is the kind of way things that are actually broadly popular can get before parliamentarians. I think it's worth more consideration by the BC legislature and just finding ways to get people more involved in our democracy so that they feel less cut off, I think is worthwhile. And maybe it's not the best tool, but it's not an unreasonable one. In the final section of recommendations from Plekis is the how to increase public accessibility, awareness, and understanding. This is a bit more of a hodgepodge. Some of the ideas seem fairly benign, like increasing the use of American Sign Language translations in the House, which seems pretty good. Others are pretty vague, like the first one off the top is utilize social media platforms to share the lived experiences of citizens as they encounter government programs and policies in their everyday lives. And I don't know what that means. I don't know if they mean people would already be tweeting out if they have a shitty time with government services. Do they want the legislature retweeting that or something?
This feels very like 2012, when everybody still liked Facebook, let's use social media to bring everyone together and highlight things feel to it. It's far from clear what it actually means in terms of how to enhance how British Columbians interact with the government.
A couple of the others in here are to increase the amount of regional and indigenous art in the parliament buildings, just as a small step towards including more of British Columbia in there, as well as trying to take a couple of small steps towards reconciliation. It seems fine. I hope they do that. I don't think it's a substantive change to colonization, but it doesn't hurt as long as they pay for the art. And finally, they want to report MLA attendance during sessions to make it more clear who's attending debates and how they're voting. A lot of votes are actually not recorded in the BC legislature if they're largely considered to pass, or if no one calls for a counted vote. They just go, all right, that passed. And that's all it says in Hansard. Having every vote counted could be nice. I don't suspect it will change much. We'll see a lot of, I would be surprised if there's more dissent among the ranks in partisan voting in BC than at any other level. If anything, I think it's probably pretty rigid that you vote with your party every time. But hey, maybe we could get proof of that.
Hey, if nothing else, it would be good to know who's actually showing up for work and not. So yeah, good suggestion there.
So overall, a bag of largely reasonable suggestions, some that could go farther, some that, I don't know, aren't necessary or a bit vague, but hopefully these are things that hopefully these are things that the new speaker looks at, is willing to consider, and hopefully the legislature keeps an eye towards reforming itself. I think we saw a lot of positive changes in the last 3 years, both on the internal standing orders. There was the whole right to bear arms situation and other changes to the standing orders. And just more efforts to make the legislature more inclusive, diverse, accountable, all those good things. Good on Plekis for starting this conversation and making sure it's presented on his way out.
And on our next segment, warming up the money printer again. Finally, the government has put out a economic statement. This comes after, what, more than a year without a budget? The last budget was in the last parliament before the last election. And we had...
Yeah, it was like March 2019.
March 2019. So it's a long time. We had a... What did they call it? A fiscal...
Snapshot.
A fiscal Instagram or something. Anyway, we had this not... Basically didn't tell us very much thing that came out.
They posted it to Facebook stories and it disappeared 24 hours later.
Yeah, so we had a brief thing back in... I can't even remember what it was. But early on in the year, probably May, June-ish time on that. And now we've actually gotten something that's not quite a full budget, but at least closer to it than anything we've seen in quite a while. So this was released Monday by Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland. I think the headline item that's comes out of it is that we are going to have a $381.6 billion deficit. Now, I am old enough to remember when $381 billion was just the entire budget.
That's a lot of money.
And then some.
And that's presuming we don't have greater shutdowns between now or whenever they started drafting this and the spring, which right now in Alberta, Ontario, and Quebec, and we're on the edge of here in BC, it's unclear. Like, we definitely might have to do some, especially in Alberta, some serious stuff to stop the spread of this virus. So on the one hand is the big deficit hole, and on the other is the roughly $100 billion they want to spend over 3 years to kickstart the economy, both short-term expenditures to keep people employed, to keep the economy rolling, to keep businesses afloat, as well as some big, larger changes starting to be funded, reflecting the throne speech that they talked about a couple weeks ago, and then they didn't walk it back. But I remember like a month before that throne speech when they were like trial ballooning, what if there's a UBI this fall and everything else? And then suddenly it's like really pared down to, we won't kill you.
Which is really just like peak Liberal Party.
Yeah. So the short-term incentives, the wage subsidy is being increased from 65 to 75% from December 20th to March 13th. The rent subsidy for businesses that covers 65% of their expenses will go until March 13, 2021. All of this is presuming it passes the House of Commons and the Senate.
It's going to pass. There is zero chance Jagmeet Singh is going to bring down the government over this.
Is all I mean.
It'll pass. It might not even be that much in the way of tweets. He hasn't been particularly firm against the Liberals in the past.
And the other short-term support for the business sector is a new highly affected sectors credit availability program. That mouthful is to support the tourism, hospitality, hotel, and art sectors with low-interest government loans of up to $1 million, basically just trying to keep them afloat. And then there's a big package for the airline sector, and for people like me who have kids, we all get $1,200 extra next year, as long as your kid is under six.
And you make under a certain amount of money. right?
Yeah, you have to make under $120,000. If you make a dollar over that, you only get $600, which is one of the weird non-sliding scales that's been rolled out. That bizarre aspect aside, the CCB, the Canada Child Benefit, is one of the strongest programs, arguably, that's been rolled out. It's been well documented that it supported bringing thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of children out of poverty and families up. So it's basically a basic income for children or families. Good program. It's an easy way to cut money out. And hey, I'm biased if I get money for it. There will also be some money going towards starting the national child care program, both supporting ongoing funding, and it's only like $20 million over 5 years to start studying national child care, but at least they're trying to point in that direction as we look at both the short-term supports and some longer effects.
That's really a little surprised they aren't moving a little quicker with that. You think they would, considering how much attention's been put on this? You think they'd lean more heavily on that?
I agree. That was a little bit disappointing not to see more push on it faster. Like, childcare is a long, slow process to roll out, as BC can attest to. But you have to start really putting the money. BC has results to show. We have tens of thousands of spaces being opened up. And they try to refer to the $7 billion, I think it is, they spent over the last 3 or 4 years federally. And they've opened a few thousand spaces across the country by supporting random little scrap programs across the country. Oh, there's a little program in Saskatchewan, so we opened up 600 spaces there. And it's like, what do you have to show for it? Like, really commit to this. And so maybe that's a pressure point for the NDP to push on. Related to that, there's also nothing new for PharmaCare. There's just a talk about how they've started some studies, and next year or the year after, they'll start ramping something else up. But there's nothing new for PharmaCare in here. And that's another big hit for a lot of families who, if you lose your job and you lose your healthcare coverage or your extended health coverage, you lose your drug benefits. So getting those kind of things out will do a lot for people, but it's not here yet. But they are still committed to their million job pledge that was in the throne speech. Part of that will be 40,000 additional summer jobs as part of an expanded Canada summer job program. That'll cost almost $500 million because they are also providing 100% of the minimum wage for all employers. Typically, they only do 50% for-profit employers and 100% for nonprofit. So that will be a big boost. I know I've hired from Canada Summer Jobs a couple times in the past and know a lot of people, especially in the charity and nonprofit sector, use that program. Good thing. There's also another $500 million going to the Youth Employment and Skills Strategy to create another 45,000 jobs over 2 years. So a big focus on youth employment, which is good to see. Waivers on student loans for the next year. No, or waivers on paying interest in student loans. But even that will cost $300 million. Money adds up quick.
Yeah, billion here, billion there. Pretty soon you're talking about some real money. And one of the package of $1 billion thrown out is for $1 billion to go to long-term care improvements. That's going to be spread on a per capita basis across the provinces. There's also $1.4 billion to the dairy industry to offset some of the effects of trade deals. Not something I'm particularly thrilled about, but if it, you know, helps chip away at the supply management, it's not the worst thing. There's also $5,000 grants that will be accessible for people to improve their home's energy efficiency, totaling $2.6 billion over 12 years. And interestingly, they're removing the GST and HST from face masks and shields.
Yeah, they claim this will cost about $95 million over 2 years, which, if you assume everyone's paying 5% GST on those face masks and shields, means this country is going to be spending $1 billion annually on face masks and shields. Now, it gets more complicated because hospitals get an 85% GST tax credit, I had to look up. So we're actually spending a lot more than that. But then there's also been a lot of purchases of masks and shields by businesses in the last while. So anyway, apparently it's a really big industry, but it definitely makes sense to me that you shouldn't pay sales tax on what is effectively medical supplies.
Yeah. I'm curious just how broadly they define that. Are we talking also like the face masks people in the construction industry wear for as like dust masks,
welding goggles,
and stuff, or respirators? Yeah, all that stuff. Like welding shields. Just how broadly is this being defined?
I skimmed through the update document. I don't remember reading exactly what the text on that was, but I have to assume it's targeting medical suppliers, but I don't know. Maybe it's anything you put on your face. Another big chunk of money, $238.5 million over 6 years, is going to be going to the RCMP to put body cams on every beat officer. That'll be a $50 million annual program thereafter. It's pitched as an accountability measure. This has been debated in the US. There's a lot of pushes for body cams because it makes sense to have better account. In theory, have footage of what cops are doing so that if they do abuse someone, you can see it. But the evidence is mixed. There's a lot of times where these cameras conveniently don't work or a number of other issues come up. And for the costs, it seems like it's another handout that's maybe not the best use of funds if we want to improve our policing.
So bystander filmed video has clearly been useful for accountability purposes. So yeah, definitely makes sense why you want body cams, but it seems to me that the bigger issue there is around the policies and how stringently those are enforced around actually using them, which it sounds like you got to get that right if you want the program to be reasonably effective. This doesn't really go into on that.
Definitely something to keep an eye on, especially if they're putting more cameras out there. A lot of money is coming out for housing. $1 billion is going to what will be called a rapid housing initiative for the CMHC. This is money for municipalities, provinces, indigenous governments, nonprofit organizations, effectively to build temporary modular housing or to acquire the land for them. We've seen, I think, in Metro Vancouver and across BC, how quickly those houses can go up. It's a matter of weeks, and it provides housing for people who don't otherwise have it, and it's cheap and it's good.
Yeah, it's good. It's not actually all that cheap relative to some other options. Temporary modular housing can be a bit cheap. They're not order of magnitude cheaper than permanent structures are. And $1 billion is good. $1 billion doesn't buy maybe as much housing as people necessarily think when they hear the billion number thrown
especially
around.
Especially nationwide.
Housing is expensive. I can't quite recall what the temporary modular housing costs, but it's like high five digits, low six digits per unit. Which divide $1 billion across that. It doesn't go as far as I think would be ideal or needs to go. But still, nevertheless, good that money's going out there.
The other half of the housing funding is $12 billion over 7 years to build up the rental construction financing initiative, targeting 28,500 new units of rental housing funded by the federal government, in addition to everything else provinces and cities are doing or more likely not doing often.
Yeah, that's good. Notice the GST on rental housing isn't in here. That's another industry's been looking for quite a bit as something that would actually make the financing work, because yeah, it's good to have all this money going up for loans, but if you have to spread 5% of your total costs, add that in and then finance it over the length of a mortgage, that can actually be be quite a bit of money that adds up and can be the case between being financially viable and not. So it would be good to also see them, in addition to providing subsidized loans, maybe look at some tax subsidies on the flip side too.
One tax subsidy for home is going to be a $400 work from home tax credit. Essentially, they're going to fix the home office tax credit and cut all of the really dumb red tape around it, where you have to basically keep every receipt and you have to have a certain like dedicated space for your home office. And it'll just be, provided it's a reasonable number of expenses, don't send us your receipts, just be pretty honest about it, and you can have up to $400 off your taxes if you're working from home.
Yeah, definitely better than the rather complicated set of rules that existed pre-pandemic, especially with the separated space thing, which my apartment's not big enough that I could have a separated workspace. It's be my desk or the kitchen table that's just in the main room. So, yeah, it's, I think, definitely fairer to the people who don't have large homes with spare rooms they can use for dedicated work from home spaces. It's just administratively a lot easier, and I don't think anyone, whether it's the people filling out the taxes or the people having to assess them, wants to go through an entire country's stack of receipts for every cost they've had over the past year for work from home.
And on the other side of the ledger, the Liberals propose a few different ways to bring in a bit more money, nowhere near enough money, though they do project getting...
Even they're not bringing in an extra $380 billion
of
revenue.
No, and they're not doing the wealth tax that the NDP proposed as an opposition day motion a couple of weeks ago, which would be 1% on income or on wealth over, I think it was like $20 million. Taxes are complicated, but
that also would not close the gap.
But I think the PBO said it would bring in a couple billion. The billions the Liberals are looking at, though, are applying GST to your digital services like Netflix and, I don't know, Disney Plus and everything else you're subscribed to. That would bring in $1.2 billion over 5 years. They would also make Airbnb pay GST, and other short-term rental things would bring in $360 million over 5 years. And then they're looking at a new digital tax, ideally with international partners also buying into this, but they'd go it alone if not. And it's really vague, but they say this would bring in $3.4 billion over 5 years. They want some kind, I think this was mentioned in a report on the media where they want to tax, I think, Facebook and other large platforms to fund CanCon. And it's really complicated and really problematic and weird.
Yeah, I think we talked about a bit about this, what, 3-4 weeks ago now? Back when they put out their report or started talking about some of these media rules. And yeah, it's far from clear to me that there's actually a very coherent sense of what it even, what CanCon and these associated funded mechanisms even should be in the 21st century.
Yeah. It's going to come back and bite them, because it's literally the Netflix tax that Harper attacked them for. And it's weird. And how do you decide who gets hit by it and who doesn't? Like, do podcasters get hit?
Actually, I think the Netflix tax was just the GST,
which
on
is a
Netflix.
Totally reasonable thing.
He attacked the Liberals. Yeah, that was a reasonable thing. Some of the other stuff they're now talking about is much less reasonable or not nearly as well thought out. I just remember from that election when Harper, did an ad standing in front of like TV with a Netflix logo on it, talking about how much he liked Breaking Bad in the least convincing way possible.
As he did with anything when he tried to feel relatable. Well, speaking of controversial tax takes, one that's largely popular, but I don't know if it's a good idea nationwide, is the Liberals now want to look at a foreign buyer's tax. Because the speculation in Cape Breton is a significant issue from foreign plutocrats, maybe?
It's like BC's had a foreign buyer's tax for a while. bunch of other places around the world happen. These always get pitched as the thing that will make housing affordable and get the real estate market to work again. And they never succeed in that. It may raise a little revenue, but it's been, the benefits of it, I think, are being drastically
oversold. Yeah, I don't think they do.
Much like they were oversold back when BC brought its foreign buyer stats in. And I don't know if you looked at the price of housing lately, but it's not necessarily any more affordable than it was pre-foreign buyer stats. It's
really hard to tease out, you know, what effect it had. I don't think they have zero effect, but I definitely agree it's probably largely oversold and it's much better as a funding mechanism. We're in the middle of a pandemic where borders have been shut or made difficult. And so foreign speculation, I have to imagine, is down. But like you say, people are still buying homes and the economic dashboards in the update show that people are buying a lot of homes. It's also confusing to me why the feds are looking at this. Like, I'm fine with a bit of jurisdiction shopping, as it were, with policies when it makes sense. But this kind of is just, I don't know. I don't feel like we need a national approach to foreign housing taxing.
Well, the other thing, in addition to it being a revenue tool, the other main effect of or main rationale of the foreign buyers tax is politically, it's a way to redirect things from kind of domestic reforms that would make winners and losers domestically, but are needed to actually kind of bring the housing market more in line with where it should be. So it's an easy way to, for lack of a better term, scapegoat on the issue of housing.
So overall, that's the fiscal update. Lots of money, lots of big numbers. Any other big takeaways you have from it?
Well, the only other thing I want to mention is, like, the $381 billion is pretty eye-popping. And there's a table somewhere in there where they add in the provincial costs, and it's, like, collectively over $500 billion. In less than a year, we've put in $500 billion into addressing COVID. So, like, very much, it would be much better if we'd, you know, put a fraction of that in early on in previous years, actually took the lessons from SARS and properly prepared for this. And the other thing is, yeah, it's had a lot of money, but worries about the deficit and long-term debt are overblown. Not only are interest rates low, but it's roughly 25% of GDP. That's a lot. It's not so much that you can't do it for 1 to 2 years and come out the other side with a little more debt cost. It's nothing that'll break the bank on this. And concerns over that, I think, are,
I think those are really important points. The other charts in the update show projections of what if we don't spend this money, and it shows the real economic, the real human even costs of the additional people who will still be unemployed in weeks, months, even years after this pandemic. Spending this money now helps keep people working. It helps keep people fed. It helps keep people alive. So I think it's reasonable to debate
whether these are
all the best ways to spend every dollar, but
almost certainly, at least some of them won't be, just because we've done so much so quickly. But in the aggregate, it was the right thing to do. And you know, the fact that these are temporary measures should be reassuring. But it also means we shouldn't try and be over-eager to apply the lessons from right now to the 2024 budget, when needing a more sustainable fiscal path will actually be more important than what we do for 1 to 2 years. When we're talking about long-term programs that'll be with us for decades, that's when you want to be much more concerned about what the long-term fiscal impacts are going to be and whether or not it will cause structural deficits.
I'm excited for my $1,200 for my kid and the $1,000 from John Horgan that we'll get by Christmas or maybe early next year. Money in my pocket, literally. Can become real selfish real quick as a voter, hey?
Yeah, that can definitely be the case.
Let's jump into quick takes. Just a few short stories. First up, one of the big things that came out this week was Dr. Mary Ellen Terfel-Lafond's investigation into racism in BC healthcare dropped this week. The report, what is the title again? The report entitled In Plain Sight is 236 pages. The summary is 70 odd pages. This basically followed the allegations that in certain hospitals, doctors and nurses were playing a game of Price is Right with Indigenous patients in the ER, trying to guess their blood alcohol level. That shocked a lot of people because it's horribly racist. Notably, this report finds that those allegations, there wasn't evidence for an organized game. But even though that seemed to have been a bit possibly exaggerated, the review did find extensive profiling of Indigenous patients based on stereotypes about addictions. It called the results of the 9,000 interviews they did disturbing. And so a lot in here, there's 24 different recommendations for the government, health authorities, medical schools, the regulators, etc., on how to address anti-Indigenous racism. Lots of different things in here. We'll link to the report. We'll link to a little bit of coverage. It's gross. And hopefully we can start taking up some of these recommendations, because this racism in our healthcare system creates differential outcomes, which means it just exacerbates itself, where Indigenous people of color in the medical system get treated worse, they seek less attention, seek less medical attention, and it spirals down. So hopefully we can fix that.
Yeah, I don't really have anything to add or any particular insights on this. You know, racism is bad. We should try and not have it in our medical system. Yeah, hopefully this is one of the steps to address that. Our next story has to do with the strata insurance issue that has been plaguing BC for a little while, as news was reported this week that the insurance industry is going to be ending its best terms pricing system at the end of this year, and it's been confirmed by the relevant provincial regulator. So strata insurance has shot up a bunch over the course of the past couple of years, and one of the things contributing to it, but not by any means the primary driver, was the system where you basically have multiple insurance providers provide partial coverage for a building, and then they'd all quote at different rates, and whatever the highest rate was from that, they just take that number and use it for everything. So the example that I've seen a couple stories on this is we have one company bidding for 30% of the building's coverage at 30 cents per $100 of insured value. You'd have another one at 25 cents. And then the final one would come in at 45 cents per $100. And then the broker would package that together and sell the whole thing at 45 cents per $100.
As a person paying, it kind of galls, it hurts to have to hear that and go, wait, I have to pay for all of the insurance at the highest rate. And I think the justification internally in the insurance industry was the broker is carrying a lot of risk, and a lot of these companies end up carrying a lot of risk given how expensive strata buildings are.
Yeah, and like risk does need to be compensated, but at the same time, the point of getting bids is to actually, you know, find the lower cost options on this. So defeats the purpose if you're not using the bids you're getting.
Yeah, the industry had collected,
for determining the overall
industry
price.
Authority had collected some data on this and said that 94% of strata properties were negatively impacted by this policy, and premiums were like 27% higher than they would have been under other models. So this won't fix a strata whose insurance went from $300 a month per owner to $600, which I've seen, but it could bring them back down to $500. I can't do that math in my head, but you can save some of them a bit of money, and hopefully that starts to show. But I suspect it won't show that quick. And like you said, not the only or arguably biggest issue out there.
Yeah, and if it is compensating for some risk, that is going to be built into the price in another way. So you won't get all of it back, but it will help a bit.
And finally, there's just a bit of a bizarre story to finish on, entitled PM Oops from National Newswatch. The Prime Minister's office got a little egg on their face this past week for releasing a press release documenting a call between Prime Minister Trudeau and Conservative leader Erin O'Toole that didn't actually happen, and they, or at least hadn't happened when they released the press release. And ultimately the release mischaracterized it as Trudeau berating and scolding Erin O'Toole, when ultimately it was a less hostile conversation in reality.
So on one hand, it's the sort of mistake that occasionally happens. Staffers will write up some stuff ahead of time, how they think it's going to go, and do some edits afterwards to align it with the actual result. And someone hits send a little early on their pre-write. And in that sense, it's some staffer is really embarrassed and probably got jacked up pretty hard in the by their superior. But like, it's at the same time, it's interesting in that it reveals what they were thinking about and how they were approaching this call. And to a certain extent, you're always going to have the various leaders of the parties square off each other and try and score points. On the other hand, you'd hope that in times of national crisis, your prime ministers and, you know, leaders of Her Majesty's loyal opposition can meet and discuss those serious issues without it becoming a point scoring match for the good of the country. And it's clear that's not how Trudeau and his staff were approaching this, which is somewhat disappointing.
Ultimately, this is a story I'd almost like completely forgotten about by the time, because this happened on the 27th, like almost a full week ago. So an amusing anecdote, but ultimately just releasing your concession, your victory speech when you ultimately didn't win. Funny, but inconsequential.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.